Hey there, gang. Patrick King here, and I want to thank you for tuning in for episode number 8 of my new audio broadcast, Talking About Horses. In these broadcasts, I try to bring you some of the best riders, horsemen, trainers, equine advocates, and thought leaders in the horse industry for tips, insights, and stories. You can listen at home, at work, in the car, or even in the saddle, either through Facebook, through YouTube, or by downloading the podcast afterwards from the iTunes store. Today, I'm pleased to bring you all the way from Australia, my friend Colleen Kelly. Colleen is a rider biomechanics expert. She recently retired as one of the world's leading teachers on rider balance, seat, position, and coordination. But she loves me so much that she agreed to come out of retirement to join us on this episode. Colleen, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Patrick, thank you for having me. I would come out of retirement for you anytime.
Oh. You're too sweet. You're too sweet. I love it. I love it. So for anybody out there that might be listening, Colleen, can you give us a little background on yourself? Talk about your history as a riding coach and that sort of stuff so folks can catch up to speed.
Well, it's really funny, actually, that we're talking here today because I'm back on my family farm that I haven't even seen in 17 years. And we have a family farm here in Queensland, Australia. And if any of your listeners want to look up the town Surfers Paradise, they're going to be really jealous because it is beautiful here. And we've got gorgeous beaches and stuff. And I didn't realize how incredible Australia is. And so I'm back where it all started. And I'm not willing to say how many years ago, actually, I am. I'm 56. So I would have been about 6 years old when I first learned to ride here. And my father's quite elderly. He's just gone into a nursing home, really happy. And but I've taken over the family farm here again. And it's hysterical because we bred, broke, and sold 1,000 horses off this property. Wow. Little horses, big horses, ponies, every kind of. We haven't had a zebra or a zebra, as you guys say, but we've had just about everything else here and every single horse problem that you could imagine. But I think about 20 years ago, I changed my specialty at university from psychology to sports science. And I was very keen in how these cowboys stay on when the horse is bucking and how the Avengers stay on at Rolex and badminton and the police, you know, they're in riots with people trying to pull them to the ground. And I wanted to know how they stayed on because, to be honest, that was not my skill. I could fall off. Like, the horse sneezed loudly, I'm on the floor. Right? It was terrible. And I'm not even exaggerating. Like, my mother said, they used to have a saying in Australia, you have to fall off 7 times or you're not a rider. Well, I never forget the afternoon that I fell off 7 times in an afternoon.
So that makes you a professional rider, right?
Well, PhD doesn't stand for what you think it does. It stands for piled higher and deeper. And I couldn't understand, especially these Australian cowboys over here. You guys over there, you've got incredible riders there too. How on earth they stay on? That was my number one thing. And I played polo cross, which is a pretty serious game, and I could never make it to the end of the match without coming off, you know. And I just wasn't a natural. I just couldn't seem to understand what the skills were. So that was it. I just spent years and years and years and years interviewing the top riders and then eventually teaching the top riders as I studied more at university and asking them, well, what do you do? How do you stay on? And then an incredible thing happened. I used to donate a lot of time just to be nice to riding for the disabled here. But then I ended up in a wheelchair, not through accident, but through illness. And I got osteoporosis and got lots of fractures. And And then I had to relearn it again in a different way. So the seat and posture to me started with, how do I stay on? How do I don't die? And also how not to be nervous. How do top riders like you get on and you're not scared? Where people like me would get on and I'm absolutely terrified. And so I went back to uni. I did about 50 million other degrees and lots more study and studied all over the world, England, America, Canada, everywhere. And now, you know, biomechanics was my field for basically all my life since then, the seat and posture of the rider.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So in all of that study, I understand you also achieved a dressage judge's certificate. Is that right?
Yeah, I kind of whacked that in there as well.
Right, because, you know, that's just a casual little thing. And if I remember reading correctly, you were the first and may still hold the record for the only applicant receiving a perfect 100% score. Is that right?
Yeah, it's incredible what happens when you cheat.
Oh, goodness.
And I did cheat, and I'll tell you how I cheated. And yes, I am the only judge to get 100% in the dressage judges exams. I cheated by not believing in myself, by people telling me that behind the vertical was fine, that open mouths is okay, that swishing tails is all right. And me looking at the rule book going, hang on, the rule book says swishing tails is terrible and grinding teeth is terrible and tongue stuck out is just vile. But all the trainers were saying that was okay, the rule book saying not okay, and I was just tearing my hair out. And so I kind of didn't know what to do in that exam, and it didn't help that I was also learning from someone that was on the Australian dressage scene for years, very, very famous. And he was one of the ones going, oh, yeah, you know, more leg, kick him out, more force, more this, where the rule book is saying relax and harmony and kindness, all this. So I read that rule book. I could quote it cover to cover. And what I did is I read the rule book, I hate to say in those days, into cassette. And in these days, you just got sound recorder on your computer. But I read the whole rule book, cover to cover, in the cassette, and I played it in the car nonstop. Like anywhere I drove, I would play the rule book again and again and again and again and again. So nobody could come at me with any kind of anything that's not in that book and say, you know, behind the vertical, excuse me, Article 418, such and such, I don't remember which one that one was, but I do remember things like Article 418, page 27, subsection 8, this, the thumb must be the highest point of the hand, things like that. So when I see the hands in a poor position, it's not Colleen Kelly says, you're bad. It's the rule book says, your thumb should be in a certain way because of your own safety and your own protection. And the rule books are about, and I'm talking about the dressage rule book,
yes,
which for Western riders, they really should read it. It's a great, great book. It's free. It's online. Just look up dressage rule book. And so the cheating was to read that book and spit it out like a machine. So that in my own doubts and my own insecurities about, you know, trainers saying these bad things are okay, offside reins, draw reins, stambons, martingales, all this, they're all fantastic. But they're against our rules. So it was really, you know, just studying and studying and studying. Because I didn't believe in myself, because I had so many big, important people to fight, and I think I won in the end. I got 100% and I didn't.
There you go, right? There you go. So how do you deal, Colleen? This is interesting to me that this point came up the way that it did. how do you deal with the riders and the trainers and, you know, even some of the judges, let's be real, that are saying that some of those other things are acceptable now, even though...
It's interesting that the judges, everybody says, oh, the judges are rewarding these things. No, they're not. The judges, I mean, we can't get out of the judges' box and whack you over the back of the head and say, listen, you idiot, you do that for that horse one more time and I'm going to hit you. I would love to do that to some of the riders. But what happens is this. People don't understand the dressage judging score. It's gotcha. 0 to 10. And if you were a gymnast or a high-carb diver or anything, or ice skater, anything that's judged 0 to 10, and I know ice skating changed recently. How dare they? Because I'm, you know, an armchair expert on ice skating. No, not really. Any of these 0 to 10, what would you have to do to get a 6 in gymnastics? You would have to fall off the beam, break your 2 front teeth, wipe up the blood, get back up and perform to get a 6. You just go home and just die. You see them disappointed when they get a 9.1. Oh, no, right. I only got a 9.1. That's terrible. Now, the dressage judges are giving Olympians 4s and 5s and 6s. Quite happily, no problem. You have a look at those Olympic scores and you'll see 0s and 1s and 2s. The judges are coming down on them. But the problem is this. That judge that gave you 6, 6, 6, 6, 6, which failed you, a 6 is, to me, a dead fail.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to the Olympics, you need a 65%. You cannot make an Olympic team on a 64. So a 64 to me is fail, dead fail, go home, you're embarrassing. But most riders will go home and open the champagne and go, oh, I got over 60.
Right.
I'm really, really good.
Right.
No, you just scraped your sorry butt through a fail, but your trainer and yourself are trying to tell you that's okay. So there's a huge difference in the supper that the judges have and the supper that the riders have. You go to the restaurant where all the judges are, and the judges go, oh, God, it was terrible today. I didn't give 1 8. It was just awful. I couldn't bear it. I have to have a, you know, gin and tonic to get over all these terrible horses. You go to the riders' supper that night. Oh, I won. I did this. I'm fantastic. I got a 62, which is a fail.
Right.
I got a 62, and I'm the best. So until the riders realize that 6 is bad, nothing will change. And funnily enough, the marks at most countries haven't changed in 30 years. They haven't changed in 30 years. The judges have been saying it. The riders just won't listen.
Interesting.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's a big hint to read the rule book. You know, you read the rule book. My first question of anybody in dressage is, what's the number one thing they're judging? And you watch people's faces just drop going, the number one thing they're judging, impulsion? Nope. Straightness? No, definitely not. That's the higher, way higher up the list. But the number one thing they're judging, is the horses on the bit? No. And you'll see them go through 37 answers and we're going, how many lessons have you had?
Right.
Oh, I've been studying for 17 years, and just asked, and you don't know the number one thing they're judging. And it's really interesting. The number one thing they're judging is the walk within a range of 90 to about 96 beats per minute and stays there in collected walk and extended walk, stays exactly the same speed. And the trot between about 150, 160. All these numbers are on my website. You can just search for music and dressage. And that the canter is about 95 to 99. and stays there, that it doesn't get slower in pirouettes and selection, and it doesn't get faster in extension, that it has three speeds, that's it. The top riders know this, and they adjust their music accordingly. They seriously cheat. They have four or five different trot music. They'll have a trot music for Piaf, they'll have a trot music for extension, two different musics. So until that very clever person reads the rule book, realizes that the number one thing the judge is judging is regularity, in other words, the music, number one is the music, nobody's going to change these marks, not for another 20, 30 years, until somebody comes along and figures out, oh, the judges judge from the rule book. If I read the rule book, I might do better. So I think the judges aren't as bad as that. Look, okay, of course you get a few idiot judges. You get a few idiot riders too, and it all works out.
Right.
But I think the judges genuinely give the blue ribbon, or the red ribbon in Canada, God bless them, the blue ribbon to the one that wins. So, you know, you get 30 horses in front of you, and normally the right horse will win. The marks might not be exactly accurate, but as soon as riders realise six is a fail, then things are going to really start to change.
Gotcha. Well, and I mean, I guess the reality is the judges aren't giving the ribbons anyway. They're giving the score, and so the rider that shows up that gives the ride that scores well enough is the one that gives himself the ribbon, yeah?
Oh, yeah, always go to a show with no horses.
Yeah, right.
I don't know how many blue ribbons I've got because there's no one else in the class.
Right.
But one thing I must say about that is that years and years ago, I started judging what we call showing here in Australia, or hacking, kind of like a big breed show, very, very popular in Australia. And I started judging that before I started judging dressage. And I remember that somebody said to me one day, you know, just one horse came in. I was obviously going to get a blue ribbon. And one of the senior judges said to me, I wouldn't give that horse a blue ribbon. And I said, well, you've got to give it a blue ribbon. It came. There's no other horses. She said, give it a red ribbon. I'm like, oh, don't be so rude. And she said, and I thought she was going to say, it's not of the quality to win a blue ribbon.
Okay.
And I thought, oh, God, yeah, but that's still pretty rude. You're still rocked up. I can't give a red ribbon to somebody. Anyway, so she was the senior judge, so I sort of wasn't allowed to speak. And then she went out with a blue ribbon and a red ribbon in her hand, sort of secretly, had a word to the rider, and the rider took the second ribbon.
Really?
And I'm like, oh, that's so rude. The judge comes back. You know what she said to me? She said, I gave the rider the option. Do you want a blue ribbon or a red ribbon? And the rider took the second. I said, the rider took the second? She said, yes. She said, because if I had given them the blue ribbon, that meant she couldn't go in any amateur classes anymore. And I went, question judge. Never question a judge, because you don't know what they're thinking. And they're always trying to do the right thing. But don't question the judge. Question them at dinner that night, and question them very politely.
Yeah.
Because you never know. We're really trying to do something good. And the other thing about horses that just rock up just with one horse is perhaps nobody else was good enough to show up. You won anyway.
Yeah.
Nobody else was good enough to present a horse in that class. You won.
Right.
You won fair and square.
Right.
So, yeah, it's interesting. So.
Yeah, wow. So all this talk about judging and competing, so you've, if I understand this correctly, you've worked with people in 7 different Olympics. Is this correct?
Yes, I have.
That's tremendous. Okay. I don't know that there's a whole lot of people that can say that. Now, were they all riders?
They were all riders. Oh, gosh, I've worked with so many riders. It's incredible. over the years, and not just Olympics, but because, I mean, Olympics are exciting, but for me it's also World Equestrian Games, because you have the other sports involved there, such as reining, etc., and of course vaulting. And so the World Equestrian Games for me is actually often more exciting. And the World Equestrian Games in Kentucky, I actually lost count, and I still don't know how many pupils I actually had worked with at the World Equestrian Games. It probably would have been about 25, because the whole American vaulting team came running up to me in their uniforms going, Colin, we're in our uniforms, isn't this exciting? And individually over the years, I've given them lessons, or they come to clinics or whatever, and there was reiners that I'd worked with. There was even a driver that I'd worked with, and that was into driving. So, yeah, 7 Olympics since Barcelona, can you believe it? And wow. Some have been wonderful, some have been actually terrible, very sad, since things that I didn't want to see. And as when I were talking about before, I'm actually writing, I've retired to write a novel. It's a bit of a tell-all behind the Olympics about some of the bad things that I've seen behind the Olympics. And so you can read about that in the novel when it comes out, or the movie when it comes out. So, it's 7 Olympics. But competition's not really my deal. It just that's more the people that I work with. That's more their deal. I've competed myself for very many years at Grand Prix level. But I love performing, and I love performing like in evening gala shows, and especially if we have vaulters, or if we have ribbon girls coming down from the ceiling on ribbons, or any kind of fire. I'm a bit of a pyromaniac. I love performing in those gala evening shows. Any kind of dressed up, wearing some beautiful gown and a frieze, and you're out there. I love all the performing stuff, because to me, performing is only about beauty. It's got nothing else. It's not about winning. It's not about losing. It's not about, is this horse on the bench? It's about making some little child smile in the audience, It's about giving somebody a better evening or a better day. It's about some little abused kid there sitting in the audience that, is having a terrible trouble at home, and at least for an hour and a half, they're watching something beautiful, like Cirque du Soleil. That's my true love. I love all that stuff. And you may know that I performed for many years with Rex the Wonder Horse and Patch the Wonder Dog here in Australia. And my own dog Amber is being flown out to Australia as we speak, and I'm missing her desperately.
I'm sure. Wow. So you just moved back full time to Australia, yeah?
Yes, full-time to Australia. It doesn't mean I won't stop travelling. I don't think I'm full-time anywhere ever. But back on the family farm. I'm not teaching riding this year at all. I've got only one commitment this year, and that's in New Zealand for Equitana, which is a really, really huge thing over there. Mm-hmm. And Equitana has been fabulous to me over the years, and it's very worth going to see an Equitana if you can in Germany or Australia. They're incredible shows.
Yes.
The biggest shows you'll ever see.
My friend Wendy Murdoch goes over there and teaches, and as a side little deal every year, she does safaris in Africa, and she's talking about doing a safari Equitana and taking a group of folks over just because it's such a huge event.
We'll make sure you whack a shrimp on the barbie for her.
There we go. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So with all these shows and with all these competitors that you've worked with, and with all of the evening performances and things like that, surely something that would come up, and I want to spend some time chatting about this if that's all right with you, but surely something that would come up is nerves on the part of the rider or the performer, right, if they're not riding in the performance. What's your take? Why do we have riders getting nervous in these situations, and what is it that they can do to help themselves with that?
Look, I think that everybody's been through that. I have been so scared with my horse. I had a horse called Collaborator, and this thing dumped me on the floor 3 times in a row, and badly, like broken bones kind of badly. And I was so scared of that horse that when I went in the stable to brush the horse, I would burst into tears. I would throw up on the way to lessons. I mean, that's how scared I was of the horse.
Wow.
Now, I've identified, I think it was, I read an article a million years ago identifying 8 major fears. Bucking, rearing, bolting, shying. This obviously doesn't apply to most people, but looking bad physically, for example, fat, cellulite, and for me, it was big boobs. Now, I know that sounds funny. I don't know, people are probably laughing at that, but when you're a girl and you're a double G cup and you're coming down the center line and it looks like two cats fighting in the bag. And the fillings are not stale where they should be, and the fillings are trying to jump out of the top paddock and jump below the bottom fence and jump everywhere. When you're a double G cup and your chest is huge, it actually stops me riding. It didn't stop me riding at home. It stopped me riding in public anywhere. For probably 10 or 15 years, no one saw me ride. In fact, a lot of people didn't even think I could ride. And then finally, I lost a lot of weight, and I got it together a little bit more mentally. And then I went, the hell is it? I can actually do this. And I didn't do it for very long. I only went back competing for a couple of years. But I went back, won everything, showed them how I was done, and then retired. So I really know how it could be one of many fears. Bercy, you need to know what the fear is. Is it a fear of rearing? Is it a fear of bucking? Is it a fear of the judge? Is it a fear of how you look visually?
Yeah.
Look, in other words, are you fat? You look tragic. In your mind, not in my mind as a judge. And I'll get to that in a sec. What is the fear? Is the fear your parents looking at you and your parents criticizing you? Is the fear your husband going to have a go at you? Is the fear that your coach thinks you're an idiot and here we go, we're going to have exactly the same lesson next week? What is the fear? Because the fear of rearing is not the same as the fear of your boobs bouncing in kidding trough.
Right.
And so that fear has to be nailed down probably to your childhood. Probably so deep in your soul and so deep in your personality that a lot of people don't even want to go there, and that's why they probably never fix it.
Yeah.
But if you're smart enough to go, hang on, I've got a sore foot. So what do I do with my sore foot? Well, I'll go to get some new shoes. Well, that didn't work. I'll go to get some pads for my new shoes. But that didn't work. Well, I'll go to a podiatrist. Well, that didn't work. Well, I'll go to a chiropractor for my sore foot. That didn't work. I'll go to a surgeon. He fixed it. And somewhere along the line of just getting more and more educated about whatever that problem is the answer. So I think what a lot of people fear is what other people think about them.
Yeah, more of an egoic fear.
Yeah, it's an egoic fear. So either you go, I'm going to be strong. I'm not going to be. I'm not going to worry about what they say. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but you know, whatever that is saying, all of that. To me, none of that ever worked. To me, finding a reason in your soul while you start. So here's an example. I had a client, lives in North Carolina, very, very famous lady, has a beautiful string of horses. They weren't beautiful when I got there, but they're beautiful when I left. One of them was a psychopath that should have been on Criminal Minds. We couldn't lead this horse from the ramp and back to its own yard without it rearing and flipping over and throwing itself on the ground. I mean, these horses were nuts. And fully grain, way too much grain, not enough work, the typical scenario.
Right.
And anyway, I got there, and these horses, beautiful, after about 5 seconds, and we got them off all the grain, and they started acting normally, and she started to do really well. And then she started to do really, really well. And then she started to win every single competition she went in, didn't matter what it was. And we're talking about USDF Horse of the Year kind of level.
Wow.
Then Spider started to get freaked out. And we used to have something, because she competed nearly every weekend. She had a lot of horses, a lot of clients. And we used to have this thing called Whingy Wednesdays. And every Wednesday, oh, no good. My horse is rotten. I'm having a terrible time. Oh, he never goes forward. He never behind. He won't go on the bed. He's never straight. He's always quarters left. And oh, my shoulders are falling in on the circle. Oh, the hot, whingy Wednesdays, right? And it would be just, and I've been, look, it's okay. It'll be fine. We'll get it. We've still got a couple of days to go. You don't have to be there till Friday. You know all of this. Finally, one Wednesday, after months of these Wednesdays, shut up! You're not living in a cave in Afghanistan. You're not being shot at by rebels. Right. Your shoulders are falling in on the circle. Get a freaking grip, right? And, you know, because, look, literally, it's not that serious.
Right.
So, of course, that weekend, she wins again. Next Wednesday, she's whinging again. So next week, she wins. So then I come to Australia. Now I'm getting whingy Wednesday emails.
Oh, no.
So I said to her, okay, this has got to stop. Now I'm in Australia. I'm not going to hold her hand anymore. I'm done. You have to decide right now why you are riding. Are you riding to win medals? In which case, if you're riding to win medals, that's okay. It's a business. Work 9 to 5. At 5 o'clock, someone else goes and looks after your horses and you go home. It's right. A business. A lot of people do that and it's okay.
Right.
Are you riding because it's a pet and you love it and it's cute? Are you riding because you have low self-esteem and this is really big and you can control it and aren't you great and this makes you feel good? Why do you ride? So I get this email back. She goes, I actually don't know. I'm a professional. I like it. But I actually don't know. So I said, all right, well, let's make up a reason. How about this? 1 in 5 girls are sexually abused. 1 in 8 boys are sexually abused in the United States and in Australia, sadly. Why don't you ride for one of them? She said, what are you talking about? I said, sooner or later, in the crowd, there will be a little girl watching you who's, I don't know, 10 years old, and she's being sexually abused or beaten up or dad's an alcoholic or mum's a drug addict, and she's watching this beautiful lady on a black horse with a tail softly floating left and right with a big smile on her face and the horse's mouth soft and the reins loose and no drugs and no whips and no spurs and just beauty. How about you go ride for her? And I ended the email. Sunday night, I get a phone call from America, which is Monday my time, with her bawling on the end of the phone. I said, all right, what happened? She said, I arrived Sunday morning very early to my class. There was nobody there at the competition, except you would not believe it. A little girl. Oh, I'm getting emotional even saying it. Standing by the arena. There was this little girl. The little girl said to her as she went in, can I pat your horse, miss? She said, look, I'm just about to ride, but if you wait there, I'll let you have a pat on the way out. Anyway, so she goes in and she wins the competition. She's on the way out. She said to the little girl, Yeah, which you can't do legally now, you need me. But at the time, it was okay. Yeah, put the helmet on your head and get on my horse and I'll lead you back to the stables. And she led the little girl on her Grand Prix horse back to the stables. And about an hour later, she over the loudspeaker, she hears, "Ladies and gentlemen, we have a missing child on tour."
Oh, no!
This kid had basically run away from her mum as soon as she found these beautiful black horses and she was playing with the horse. The mother rocks up at the stables. She meets the lady that was riding, and it turns out the mother's only just lost her husband. She has no money, and as a day out, she decided to take the little girl down and watch the horses. Of course, she could never afford to have a lesson or anything like that, So she just come and watch the horses. So, sure enough, that little girl is now probably about in the middle, probably late 20s, riding professionally for this woman in the Carolinas. She's made a life out of it. How about that?
No kidding. All because of a change of perspective.
That's your reason to ride. You will never be nervous again as long as you live.
Yeah.
If your ego is the reason to ride, well, go and get some Valium. That's the only way to go. Get out of your ego, take your Valium, win your ribbon, but and you will be happy, but you will never have joy. You will be happy, but you'll never have joy.
Yeah.
How about that? Oh, so deep and meaningful.
total change of perspective. So for riders that are coming up onto this egoic fear, they really just need to find out why they ride. Have their reason.
Yes. Love more. And give more. If you start giving, like, because she would have ridden that day with that one little girl. There was no audience there. It was a competition, but, you know, some Sunday morning there's nobody there.
Yeah.
The judge, the rider, and not that. That's it. You know, the thing is, if you're riding for the audience, some of those people are going to hate you. And hate you. I mean, I get the most vile emails sometimes in Facebook messages from people that loathe me. And they, you know, they live in Scotland. I've never been to Scotland.
Wow, yeah.
They hate me. And the weirdest thing is I get emails from people that live in, you know, the Outer Hebrides, and they love me. I've never been to the Outer Hebrides. So you've got to really start to go, listen, you know, there's a lot of crazies out there for a start. You just don't listen to them. Find that reason to give. If you're riding to give to an audience, I mean, I have cried at nearly every performance I've ever given on stage. I'm out there bawling my head off. I'll look at my horse, I'll do a stand away, which is a trick where you send the horse running away and he stands there and he looks at you and then he chooses to come back again. And the sending away, a lot of people can't do that send away and come back. And when I do the send away and the horse is standing there just looking at me, I'm like,
right.
I don't even know the audience is there. I wouldn't even have a clue.
Yep.
And I remember the very first time I came back to competition after 14 years of not riding at competitions, I didn't read the rule book, and there'd been a real change, and the bit that I was riding in was illegal. Oh, my God. It was a struggle. I never laughed so much in all my life. And what a stupid mistake to make from a judge, you know.
Right.
I was retired at the stage. And I didn't care at all when I was eliminated. What I cared about was I got left canter in my warm-up. Because I've been trying for left-hander all week, and the left-hander was all wrong bend and all upside down. And I went, I got left-hander. I don't care. I got left-hander. Who cares? I can run a competition next weekend. And also realize I put a chart on some of the kids' walls of their Olympic, you know, if they want to go to the Olympics. I go, okay, Tokyo. What's the date of Tokyo? October, whatever it is, blah, 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 and I'll put the date. And I'll put a calendar all the way back to Friday, August the 25th, which it is here. It's already Friday. See, Australia leaves and everything. And I put the calendar back to today's date, every single day, all the way to Tokyo Olympics. Or the goal might be all the way to ride in an endurance ride, or all the way to ride in a charity ride, or whatever your goal is. Put every single day and map it out that way, and you go, oh my goodness, I have 327 competitions before Tokyo. And I'm worried about this one. I'm freaking out about number 16.
Right.
And I've got 300 and something to go. Right. The competition is this weekend. The competition is next weekend. And to me, I've won or lost by how much my horse loves me on Sunday night.
Yeah, for sure.
If my horse is low cortisol, which is low stress, and I'm trying to bring in cortisol testing for all competition horses.
Mm. Boy, now, that would be cortisol, a game changer, wouldn't it?
Cortisol is the stress hormone and can be tested easily and immediately by a very inexpensive saliva swab.
Wow.
It tests how much stress you put your horse under. And people say, oh, but it's stressed by traveling. Good, don't compete it. Oh, well, it's stressed because it's got a bit of the flu. Good, don't compete it.
Right.
Oh, it's stressed because it got... Good, don't compete it. I was stressed because I wear spurs and I kick it up the guts because I think I'm a footballer trying to kick a football out of the line. I mean, the things they do to horses. Well, a cortisol saliva test, wow, wouldn't that change the game?
Yeah,
I wonder who would actually come. Stop nobody.
Right. Right.
Yeah, because we don't need horses for warfare anymore. That's gone now.
Yeah.
We still need horses for the police, for crowd control. We still need horses in developing countries for, you know, for agriculture. And but we don't need them for warfare. So why do we need to kick them up the guts like that with the spurs and everything? That's all. You can't do that anymore. That's, well, for start, it's illegal. It's just nobody's prosecuting the cases.
Right.
It's very illegal.
Right.
Nobody's prosecuting the cases. No, no. Kind of sad. So, yeah, to me, it's all a bit more, if you go into a deep philosophical reason about why you're there, why you're riding, you know, everything's easy then. I could go out and compete tomorrow and have the worst time of my life if I was out there to make Colin Kelly better or more famous, or I'd be crying, I'd be upset, I'd be stressed. If I lost, I'd be upset. If I won, I'd be excited that I'm going to lose again next weekend, so then I'm going to cry again. Are you kidding?
Right.
And I also don't think people realize we are such an elite minority. We are the wealthiest people in the world, and where we won't give $20 to World Vision to help a starving child, we'll easily go and buy a $400 bit. You know, get a grip.
Right.
If you get the now, if you're riding like I was in the end, to bring beauty and fun and joy to people's lives and joy to the horses' lives, and have, instead of a horse dying in wounds and long feet and in a dirty old paddock, that they have lovely care and beautiful skin grooming and all of that, and lovely trimming and feeding and teeth and all of that. And by the way, just off topic, I always, always, always get my horse's teeth x-rayed. Every time the horse's teeth are done, I get an x-ray. It's very cheap.
Yeah.
It's very easy to get done, and nobody gets their horse's teeth x-rayed. And I would never buy a horse or take a horse as a rescue unless the teeth have been x-rayed. because I tell you, we saw a tooth, I'm not joking, coming out of the back of a horse's ear.
Yeah, ear teeth. Yes, I've heard stories of ear teeth. Yes.
Yep. The teeth coming out of the back of the ear. Yep. The out of the back of C1. It had grown into C1 right out of the back of the ear.
Yep. Yep. I've heard stories about that. People can't figure out why they have trouble bridling or why the horses are so ear sensitive and things like that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, how about this? I had a horse that bucked, and the head rider of the Royal School almost gave this horse to me. I did pay a little bit, but it was nothing. I mean, this was an imported German horse, and I spend more at Starbucks. You know, it was nothing. And this horse bucked and bucked and bucked, and he said to me, he goes, I said to him, have you ridden it? He goes, I'm very ridiculous. I'm not getting on it. Why would I want to kill myself, you know? And I did all the training from beginning to end, you know. As I said, we've bred, broke, and sold 1,000 horses on a property. Broke is not the right word, you know. You know what I mean.
Right.
But this thing I could not fix. It was like, oh, my goodness. And somebody said to me one day, they said, if you can't fix the horse, you can't fix it. It's not fixable. There's something wrong. There's physically wrong with the horse. And I was there, and I went all over it, and it turned out the horse had an osteoma, which is just a bony lump pushing against its back tooth, which apparently was invisible. The dentist couldn't see it. On X-ray, and a $200 operation, and I had hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of horse.
Wow.
How about that?
Wow.
And
dental care is so often overlooked, and that's something that I preach to everyone as well. You know, the dental care, there's so much of it that so many issues that we see that will come directly back to that. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes, saddle pads for me, and, you know, nose bands. Oh, don't even start me on tight nose bands. I don't even know what to do anymore, because I'm leaving an industry probably as bad, or if not worse. But that's partly what my book is about, is, you know, we all know something terrible happened at Rio, allegedly, and we all know something that terrible happened at Beijing, allegedly, two different riders.
Yeah.
Allegedly, so it's correct. Very, very, very serious. And so I found that I couldn't do anything about it legally. So I am writing a novel. It obviously won't be about those riders, but it'll be pretty close. And that's all I can do, and pray. Because this noseband thing is, I mean, when I was a head technical delegate for Australia for our championships, what you would call the SPCA, what we call the RSPCA here, contacted me prior, about 3 or 4 days prior, and warning me about a particular rider that they were trying to catch, but he didn't, unfortunately, show up. He'd been forewarned, unfortunately. And to look for wire underneath the nosebands in competition.
Oh, wow. Yep.
For wire. And that was the RSPCA contacting me as an official delegate, saying, please look out for that. That's the latest.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, thank you. Thanks for that phone call, you know. Like, oh, boy, what did you do?
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Well, there's a lot of stuff that goes on that, you know, is certainly not what we would want to have happen. And I guess the best we can do for everybody, aside from write a book for them, you know,
start writing, I'll buy yours.
Exactly, right?
And you have to personally sign it.
Right, and I guess the best we can do from there is just prove that better horsemanship just works better, you know.
Yes, and I think that love conquers all. Love trumps hate. It always has and always will.
Yes.
The horses and love will win in the end, I hope. And more publicity of the good stuff. I mean,
yeah.
I spent years being hated by half the community, and I had a lot of enemies when I'm leaving this industry, because I spoke out on drugs, I spoke out on beating, I spoke out on whipping horses to to get PR. I spoke out on you know, Behind the Vertical. Don't even start me on Rolker. I mean, at least that's illegal. But what about Behind the Vertical?
Right.
Behind the Vertical to me is bad, you know. And, you know, because I spoke out on all of them and very loudly, and I didn't care who, they got upset with me. I don't know that I changed very much. I brought awareness to the bad stuff. And so what I'm trying to do with my Facebook page now is, certainly I'm still on all the anti-Rolker pages and all of that, but what I'm trying to say more is the good stuff. So I remember one day going through Facebook and deleting every single bad stuff. Well, maybe not all the bad stuff. I'm still going to have my face sometimes. But deleting really 75% of my bad stuff. To try to do it nicer, to try to say, hey, this is a nice shape of a horse. This is, look at this lovely loose reins. Look at this lovely pole heart. Look at this lovely horse just in front of the vertical. Look at this person with straight feet not kicking the hell out of their horse.
Right.
Look at, you know, and I think publicity on the good side.
Yeah.
And I hope my book is horrible, and I hope my book is beautiful, and that it shows the two sides of the book is called The Last Wild Horse, and it looks at literally the last wild horses and compares them now in a sort of a tell-all behind the scenes, you know, leaving the industry spinning and running. Because there's things that have got to stop. There really, really has to stop in our industry. And and people like you and your students and your followers, that they're leading the way, especially the youngsters. You know, they're the future. They're the ones that are going to be writing the books and taking your work on. When you're an old man in 30, 40, 50 years time, sitting doing some technological thing that we're doing right now.
Right,
and,
exactly.
Giving your best advice.
Exactly. Well, and hopefully, like you said, you know, and I like the way you said that, instead of bringing awareness to the bad stuff, bringing awareness to the good stuff, you know, because I do feel like that is so important. We can get so focused on the negative. We can get so overwhelmed with the bad stuff that then that's really all we see, and it's all we're promoting. And if it's all we're promoting and all we're seeing, then it almost kind of becomes, I don't want to say acceptable, but people will become accustomed to it based on it's what they're so used to seeing, you know?
Well, it's really funny. I have, I don't have cable out here. I've only just arrived in Australia and I haven't even had the moment to have it connected. We've got wonderful free everything in Australia, free medical, free optical, free dental, and great free television. Mm-hmm. And so you don't actually sort of really need to buy cable. So I'm doing this with my TV as well. I turn on the news at 6 p.m. every night. I see the headlines. And as soon as something goes bad, I turn it to, which is our Channel 1, which has reruns of the old television comedy MASH.
Oh, nice.
And, well, it makes the funny side of war.
Yeah.
And as Spain happened the other day at Barcelona, I've walked down that street in Barcelona.
Mm.
I've walked over London Bridge with my sister. I've been to these places. When Leonardo da Vinci Airport was bombed, I've been right at that counter.
Wow.
You know, I know these places because I travel so much. So as soon as the bad stuff comes on, I see, okay, Barcelona, I say a prayer for them, and I turn it immediately off.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I'll sit here crying.
Yeah.
Going, oh no, you know, Las Ramblas, I remember where we had supper. No, I can't do that. I have to turn on some rock and roll music or turn on MASH. I said, no, we can't do that because that's very bad for an athlete's training to listen to sad music, watch sad stuff on TV, watch sad stuff on Facebook. You become aware of it, spend some money, donate, and get on with it. Because otherwise, if you're an athlete, and especially a professional athlete, you'd be sitting in front of the TV crying all day long, sucking your thumb.
Right.
And,
exactly.
You know, a lot of people, funny, I have a go in my book of people that say that they have low self-esteem. And they say, oh, I've got low self-esteem. I say, good, you deserve low self-esteem. And I say, what? What do you mean? I say, well, esteem. What is esteem? Well, esteem is when you esteem somebody. They're an important person. They've done something. So who do you esteem? Well, Mother Teresa, I esteem. I esteem Gandhi. I esteem Mandela. And you're sitting on this couch, why would I esteem you? You've done nothing. Get off the couch, I'll esteem you. And guess what? You will esteem yourself.
Right. There we go again, changing the perspective, right? I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
You deserve low self-esteem because you've done nothing for humanity. Stay on the couch, keep watching TV, and do nothing to waste space. Or go to the local soup kitchen and help out. Donate at the hospital.
Yeah.
Give money to beggars. I don't know. Do whatever your thing is. Help the Congo get out of the worst war since World War II. Or, help the slaves in China. I don't know. Do something. But then your self-esteem will be great.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's great because that goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago about bringing awareness to the good stuff, right? Doing something good in spite of.
And you you need a goldfish. Sell your horse, get a goldfish. If you have no self-esteem, get off the couch, go and do something good for civic humanity. Sell your darn horse and buy a pet rock.
Right, for sure. For sure.
And you're dangerous on a horse.
Right.
You shouldn't be with horses. You know, there are people that shouldn't be with horses. They need a chihuahua. Don't play with it.
Absolutely.
And, because horses are dangerous. They are 8 times more likely to kill you than a professional motorcycle race. And, it's the most dangerous sport on the face of the earth. And there's other ways to hunt horses if you have low self-esteem and you're scared of horses. One of my friends, oh, my God, she is the most amazing trainer. She's in Canberra. And she has minis, and people go, oh, miniature horses, what do you want a miniature horse for? She goes to nursing homes and disabled villages and children's, like little events and things like that. Never charges. It's not like a faith kind of thing that she would go to. She takes the minis to Ronald McDonald House. She's taught the minis to play the piano. She's taught the minis to... play the guitar. She's taught the minis to do every single trick. She taught one of the minis to go and open the cupboard. She goes, where's my little piggy? Where's my little piggy? And the little mini goes and opens the cupboard and gets this little plastic pink dish and holds it on its nose and it looks like a little piggy.
Too cute.
Oh, man, how cute is that? You don't have to be riding Rolex.
Right.
You don't have to be riding, really dangerous horse sports. There's other ways to be in the industry in non-dangerous ways. And if you have really low self-esteem, until you pick yourself up, you need to be in a less dangerous version of the sport.
Right.
That can be giving back to humanity. There's a lot of trick horses out there that sign autographs and the elephants at the Taronga Zoo that raise money for the elephants in Africa. They all draw little paintings and all of this. Come on, there's other ways to do it. You can keep your horse, but not be in such a dangerous situation,
So I'm gonna just interrupt you here real quick, Colleen, because we're coming really close on our hour mark here that I think we're gonna get kicked off of our audio. So a lot of this we're talking about the egoic side of fear and finding your reason why you're riding. So if you'll hang on with me here, Colleen, I'm gonna bump us over into a second broadcast. So episode 8, part 2. So everybody who's out there listening right now, be sure, stick around, tune in again, refresh your page.
We're going to talk about some feet and posture too.
And that's absolutely right. We've got a ton of stuff to talk about yet. So with this episode mostly focused on egoic fear, now let's talk about physical fear and let's talk about biomechanics and position and I want to hear just how important the rider's core really is. So I'm going to pause us here, Colleen, and we're going to be back live in another minute or so. Gang, stick around, invite your friends back, and join us for episode 8, part 2 here in just a moment.